This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 15th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, the Senate cuts millions of dollars of funding from ACORN, the community group that develops projects for low-income communities. Also in Washington, the White House reveals a plan to make America's vehicles more fuel efficient.
The new standards will conserve 1.8 billion barrels of oil.
And India's version of the New Deal faces accusations of fraud and corruption.
Some people have certainly got jobs, but on the whole, there are rogue states where they look upon this program as a means of making money.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A group of both Palestinians and Israelis presented a broad proposal for peace today, and the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East met with the Israeli Prime Minister. Free Speech Radio News's Ghassan Banoura reports.
The 400-page-long peace plan offers a Palestinian state in nearly 98% of the West Bank, all of the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinian-populated areas of Jerusalem. The plan was put forth by a group of ex-government officials from both Palestine and Israel, experts and former negotiators. They are known as the Geneva Initiative. When the plan was released today, none of its Palestinian authors were present. The proposal will be submitted to Israeli President Shimon Peres later this week. Meanwhile, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, failed today to reach an agreement with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on a freeze of Israeli settlements, a condition set forth by Palestinians and the U.S. before they resume peace talks. Netanyahu told Mitchell during their meeting today that Israel will not freeze settlements in the West Bank, only temporarily slow them down, while settlement construction will continue in Jerusalem. Mitchell had hoped to reach an agreement on the matter before next week's United Nations General Assembly meeting, where President Obama is planning to hold a three-way meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Ghassan Banoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
A UN fact-finding mission on the 2008-2009 Gaza conflict issued its report today. Richard Goldstone led the mission and says they found strong evidence that serious violations were committed.
The mission concluded that actions amounting to war crimes and possibly, in some respects, crimes against humanity were committed by the Israel Defense Force. Turning to the Palestinian armed groups, there's no question that the firing of rockets and mortars was deliberate and calculated to cause loss of life and injury to civilians and damage to civilian structures. The mission found that these actions also amount to serious war crimes and also possibly crimes against humanity.
Goldstone noted that the UN mission focused not on acts carried out in the heat of battle, but on policies that were adopted and military actions that were taken. Somalia is investigating yesterday's air raid by U.S. helicopters that killed senior al-Shabaab leaders. Somali Prime Minister Shamarka said today that his government supports U.S. military actions targeting foreign terrorists and knew about yesterday's raid before it happened. He added that the government has not confirmed how many were killed.
In fact, some reports say that four or five people were killed in the raid, but we don't have the exact number of deaths and their names. We hope to present that when we have ended our investigations.
The Somali extremist group al-Shabaab has confirmed the killing of al-Qaeda commander Abu Yusuf Saleh Ali Nabhan. The group's spokesman held a phone press conference for local media this afternoon.
The American infidels attacked a car carrying our brother Abu Yusuf Saleh Ali Nabhan and three of his Mujahideen bodyguards. The attack was carried out by six helicopters, and then they took our brothers. We cannot confirm if the Mujahideens were martyred on the spot or seriously wounded and then taken.
This report was prepared by our Mogadishu correspondent, Shafi Moyadin Abukar. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, said today that it's very clear that more resources are needed to fulfill President Obama's goals for Afghanistan.
A properly resourced counterinsurgency probably means more forces. And without question, more time and more commitment to the protection of the Afghan people and to the development of good governance.
Mullen appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee at hearings on his renomination as the nation's top military man. Armed Services Committee Chair Senator Carl Levin asked Mullen about the status of any troop buildup.
Admiral, has General McChrystal submitted yet a request for specific additional resources for Afghanistan?
No, sir, he's not.
Has a decision been made on whether to commit additional U.S. forces to Afghanistan beyond the 17,000 combat troops and the 4,000 trainers that the President approved in February?
No, sir.
Has a recommendation been made by you or Secretary Gates to President Obama relative to sending additional troops to Afghanistan?
Sir, we've made our recommendation based on the assessment, but we have not having received the request from General McChrystal yet, we've made no recommendation with respect to forces.
While avoiding specific estimates of how many troops will be needed overall, Mullen did say that another 2,000 to 4,000 trainers are needed to work with Afghan security forces. He suggested that some of those could be NATO forces. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
The AFL-CIO continued its annual convention in Pittsburgh today and approved a number of resolutions covering green jobs, immigration, job safety, and health care. President Obama addressed the crowd and said his administration was reversing and replacing the old anti-labor executive orders with laws to protect workers' rights.
That's why the very first bill I signed into law was the Lilly Ledbetter Act to uphold the basic principle of equal pay for equal work. That's why I stand behind the Employee Free Choice Act. Because the majority of workers want a union, they should get a union.
The president also used the occasion to push for his health care reform proposal. The Senate Finance Committee is poised to deliver their health care bill this week. Obama cited a Kaiser Family Foundation report released today showing that family premiums on health insurance rose more than 130% over the last 10 years and now average $13,000 a year.
Which is why when you go in to negotiate, you can't even think about negotiating for a wage increase because the whole negotiation is about trying to keep the benefits you already have. That's not just the fault of the employer, it's the fault of a broken healthcare system that's sucking up all the money. When are we going to stop it? When are we going to say enough is enough? How many more workers have to lose their coverage? How many more families have to go into the red for a sick loved one? How much longer are we going to have to wait? It can't wait.
Labor advocates are pushing for universal coverage and a pay-or-play system, which would require employers to either offer health care coverage or a subsidy to help cover the costs. The AFL-CIO convention continues through Thursday. The Obama administration revealed new regulations for fuel efficiency today. The proposal requires automakers to meet a federal standard of 25 miles per gallon for all light-duty vehicles by 2012 and 35 miles per gallon by 2016. The plan also includes the first-ever green standards for greenhouse gas emissions, requiring all 2016 models to meet about 250 grams of carbon dioxide per mile. Automakers are concerned these changes will increase production costs. But Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood defended the administration's plans at a press briefing in the White House.
In less than 30 days, automobile manufacturers sold 700,000 cars in the United States. Ford has called back workers to begin building new automobiles. GM has called back workers to build new automobiles.
I think the automobile industry was thrown a lifeline with the clunkers program. And when you sell 700,000 cars in less than 30 days, that means that new cars need to be built.
EPA Administrator Letha Jackson was also at the briefing. She said the new fuel efficiency standards would put money into consumers' pockets.
Overall, consumers would save more than $3,000 in fuel costs over the lifetime of a model year 2016 vehicle. The majority of U.S. consumers would start seeing immediate savings of roughly $130 to $160 a year from lower fuel costs. And the new standards will conserve 1.8 billion barrels of oil, significantly reducing our dependence on foreign fuel.
The Transportation Secretary described the new regulations as a win-win situation. But how much will these measures reduce carbon emissions and U.S. dependence on foreign oil? We're on the line now with Lena Pons. She's a policy analyst at Public Citizen. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Pons.
Yeah, not a problem.
What do you think about this? Are these regulations enough, or could more be done?
The regulations that have been proposed and in the form that they've been proposed are pretty stringent. They take the 2007 energy law target and just about it's 34.1 miles per gallon they're asking for in 2016, and they push them up 4 years earlier to 2016 from 2020, which is what was mandated in 2007. So I think that this is really a historic step forward in terms of reducing oil dependence and saving greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, how does this compare to the fuel efficiency policies under the Bush administration?
Well, under the Bush administration, there were some marginal increases for light trucks, so that's SUVs and pickup trucks, in model years 2005 through 2008, and they raised those standards marginally, about 2 miles per gallon total over the period of the Bush administration, but did nothing for passenger cars until the 2007 energy law mandated that they issue new standards for model year 2011. And they did issue final standards last fall for the 2011 model year. So they issued those standards, but that was all they really did on fuel economy. So this is just tremendously, doesn't even compare, tremendously greater improvement.
Aside from regulations that mandate how many miles a car can go with a gallon, surely there are other ways of reducing dependence on foreign oil. What's the administration doing in areas like public transportation or high-speed rail, or even changing the structure of communities so that Americans don't have to use a car to go everywhere?
Most people who look at transportation energy agree that there's really three angles that you have to look at when you think about climate pollution and reducing oil dependence from the transportation sector. And those are efficiency of vehicles, the carbon content and carbon emissions associated with the fuels that you put in the vehicles, and then the number of miles that are driven per person per year. There's a lot of support from the Secretary of Transportation in looking into ways to reduce vehicle miles traveled, and he seems to be pretty committed to make sure that we get the kinds of reductions that are really needed to protect the climate. You do have to address it from all three angles in order to actually get the climate protections that you would want from the transportation sector.
How do these miles per gallons regulations that were announced today, how do these regulations compare to fuel efficiency regulations in other industrialized nations?
There are fuel economy standards in many other industrialized countries that are stricter than those that have been proposed by the Obama administration. The main constraint that changes the level of standards that are set here versus in other countries has to do with the specific fleet mix of vehicles that we sell in the United States. So that's the number of sort of larger cars and light trucks and SUVs that sort of make up a relatively large fraction of our total fleet. And that's been one of the things that has resulted in sort of this disparity that you see in other countries with their fuel economy standards.
Now, what do these fuel efficiency regulations do for reducing carbon emissions or for making air more clean? I mean, will there be a significant impact on that front?
Yes. Fuel economy standards and greenhouse gas emission standards from vehicles are pretty much directly connected because the majority of the greenhouse gas emissions that are associated with operating vehicles come from combustion of the fuel. And so when you raise the number of miles per gallon, you reduce the number of grams of carbon dioxide per mile that are emitted. So there's a direct relationship between raising fuel economy standards and reducing greenhouse gas emissions and other air pollutants.
That was Lena Pons from Public Citizen speaking about the administration's efforts to make vehicles more fuel efficient. The U.S. Senate voted to prohibit the group Acorn from receiving federal funding. This is the latest rebuke Acorn has received in several days, as Republicans are trying to cut all ties between the community group and the government. FSR N's Leon Caldwell reports.
Acorn has had a rough couple of weeks. Most recently, House Republican leader John Boehner introduced legislation to prohibit federal money from going to Acorn, also known as the Association of Community Organizers for Reform Now. This comes just one day after the Senate voted to ban money from going to the group in a housing funding bill. The group helps assist low-income people navigate things such as buy a house, refinance a home, and file taxes. Republican Senator Mike Johanns of Nebraska authored the amendment, which would prevent Acorn from even applying for public grants.
Yesterday, the Senate made a very clear, very, very clear bipartisan statement, enough is enough.
And last week, the Census Bureau cut its ties to the organization that used its members to gather information for the census. This comes as two people in their early 20s, posing as a pimp and a prostitute, traveled to five cities across the country. They released videotapes of two Acorn employees in Baltimore and one in New York, counseling them on how to buy a home for a prostitution business. The videos have been featured on Fox and also housed on the website biggovernment.com. The website is owned and run by Andrew Breitbart, a conservative media owner. Senator Johanns is a contributor to the site. So is Ken Blackwell, the former Ohio Secretary of State, accused of disenfranchising thousands of black voters during the 2004 election. In addition to this alleged videotaped scandal, Acorn has been accused of participating in widespread voter fraud during the 2008 elections. But out of 60 offices, hundreds of employees, and thousands of volunteers, no one has yet been convicted. But all this has been fuel added to a fire. The right has long targeted Acorn. Senator Johanns says his amendment will not be the last.
I wouldn't stop at this point. I mean, their behavior is so abhorrent to what we're trying to do. And so my hope is that we will stand strong on this issue, stand in a very bipartisan way, and say across the board, enough is enough.
Most Democrats supported the measure, including Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, who said he has not even reviewed the latest accusations.
There was some very disturbing reports coming out that I have not had a chance to review in detail about Acorn. That is what happened. That's the reason the vote went the way it did. It was not because of any particular success of any political group in the country. It's just that, you know, there was some bad press.
Only seven senators opposed the measure. Democratic Senator Richard Durbin was one of them. He represents Illinois, which also houses Acorn's headquarters.
And I know that the right wing in politics in America have been on a rampage against Acorn since the last election because of voter registration, particularly of minorities. But I just think it's unfair to let two or three incidents end up condemning an organization which has decades of service to this country.
It's sending a message that when the right attacks, our funding, to say you can't even compete for a grant.
Bartha Lewis is the CEO of Acorn.
It was really proof that this is bigger than just Acorn. This is the right's ability to almost use a form of modern-day McCarthyism. You know, don't associate with Acorn, anyone that even would get close with us or affiliate with us in any way is going to be vilified.
Lewis says the employees on the videotape were fired immediately. She also says there's a 10-step process that Acorn uses to help a person obtain housing. That incorporates a system of checks, she says. She also says the two undercover filmmakers just had a conversation with the employees, but never proceeded to the next steps of filling out paperwork.
So that, to me, just shows the mentality that we're dealing with, the determination that these folks will stop at nothing to sort of bring down this organization.
The measure that passed the Senate was not part of the House funding bill. The two versions must be reconciled. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The U.S. State Department says it's looking into a recent admission by Pakistan's former president that he diverted U.S. military aid to arm his country against India. Former President Pervez Musharraf had been a key ally of the Bush administration and had received billions of dollars in U.S. military aid as part of the so-called War on Terror. State Department spokesperson Ian Kelly admitted they didn't have many details on the allegations.
Mr. Musharraf is a private citizen. He provided very few details, so we would refer you to him to get these kinds of details. And I would just say, as a general principle, we take very serious, very seriously any allegation of using U.S. origin military assistance for purposes other than we had already agreed to and that we had intended them for.
Pakistan's former president made the admission in an interview with Pakistan's Express News television channel and was unapologetic about using U.S. aid to prepare for war against its neighbor. He made his recent remarks from London, where he lives in virtual exile. Reacting to Musharraf's admission, the Indian government called on Washington to more closely monitor its aid to Pakistan. India is also dealing with the breakdown of one of its social welfare programs, the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. Much like the New Deal in the U.S., the program has created thousands of jobs for people in rural areas through local infrastructure and development projects. The United Nations describes it as one of the world's largest social welfare programs, and the World Bank calls it an important cushion for India's rural poor. But this groundbreaking program is now facing several accusations of fraud and corruption. And government officials are the main suspects. From New Delhi, Bismillah Gilani has the story.
In Kishanpur village in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, dozens of villagers attack a group of social activists, hitting them with batons, yelling insults, and threatening to kill them. The activists had arrived to announce the local findings of a social audit of the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, the country's social welfare program. The audit group's team leader, Jaideep Singh, says the attackers are supporters of the village leader, who wants to suppress the results of their investigation.
We had not yet made our report public when they attacked us. It was a coordinated attempt to deny people their rights to information. They do not want the truth to come out, and with this violence, they are trying to send a message that they will not let things change.
The National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme was launched by the Government of India in 2005. The program offers legal guarantees to 100 days of wage employment each financial year to adults willing to do unskilled manual work. At its introduction, it was hailed across the country as a revolutionary step. Krishan Kaliji, editor of the Hindi News Daily Sublok, says it's the first serious attempt to eradicate India's poverty.
We have seen a number of programs aimed at eradicating poverty in the past, but the economic policies, which we adopted in the late 90s, actually resulted in compounding the problem. The government deserves credit for this excellent program. For the first time in the history of independent India, a serious attempt has been made at understanding poverty in the right way.
Initially introduced in 200 districts, the program was later passed into a law and has now been expanded to the entire rural India with an annual budget of more than $7 billion. The government says the program is successfully serving its purpose. Dr. Santosh Mehrotra is head of the Development Policy Division of the Government of India.
In the very first year, in which only 200 districts were covered, it generated over 900 million person days of work. And clearly in the next year, it generated even more. And in the current year, it has generated even more. And NREGA data tells us that the poorest of the poor are the ones who are coming out to work.
In some regions, the program is indeed doing well. Besides providing a livelihood for millions, the program is seeing the development of local infrastructure, such as roads, bridges, healthcare centers, and schools. It's also brought a noticeable decrease in the migration of laborers looking for jobs, according to the UNDP. Nathuram is an agricultural laborer from Uttar Pradesh.
Earlier, we used to go outside the state in search of work. Now we don't have to go far away because we get work here in our own village. We get 7,000 rupees for 100 days of work, and this is a good income.
But the picture is not so rosy in many other regions. Corruption seems to have permeated all levels of the program, undermining its very purpose. The villagers accuse the district authorities and village bodies or panchayats responsible for implementing the program of embezzling funds and demanding bribes from job seekers. Many workers complain of not being paid their dues. Mohammad Ikram is a resident of Hardoi.
The government says we are spending a lot of money, but nothing ever reaches us. Everything goes to the officers and their agents. We are not even paid our wages in full. They sometimes give us half of our dues, and sometimes even less than that, and the rest goes into their pockets. They never pay us according to the rates prescribed by the government.
Some government officials confirm the workers' allegations. N.C. Saxena is the former secretary of the Planning Commission of the Government of India.
It is never 100 days in a year. That is on paper. So far, the average has been about 41 and 42. Then a very large number of people who are being shown to have worked, they exist only on paper and muster rolls are fudged. Some people have certainly got jobs and somewhere the corruption is not so high. But on the whole, there are rogue states where they look upon this program as a means of making money.
Agencies implementing the program are required to supply detailed accounts of their spending twice a year. The information is supposed to be examined by a group of villagers and representatives of NGOs working for better implementation of the program. This process is called social audit. N.E. Raja, member of the Employment Guarantee Council, says it's an effective safeguard against malpractices.
There is a built-in mechanism in this law to check corruption, and that is the social audit. And we've been able to prevent fraud and corruption to a certain extent with these audits. Corrupt people can siphon money for a while, but once the social audit is carried out, they will be exposed. They cannot get away with it.
But attempts to collect the information are often met with fierce resistance from the village bodies. Krishan Kaliji says corruption is beyond control and threatens the very survival of the scheme.
There is corruption from top to bottom. An honest person cannot survive in this atmosphere, in a situation where the higher authorities have set targets for their subordinates to collect a certain amount of money, and all this is done under political patronage. How can you prevent corruption? No social auditing, however good it may be, can work under these circumstances.
In the 2009 Global Corruption Perception Index, the group Transparency International ranks India 85th on a list of 180 countries. And according to the organization's Global Corruption Barometer, politicians are the country's most corrupt lot. With cases of corruption piling up, many are calling for a revision of the entire program. Social activists say public participation at all levels is the only way to save the program that has tremendous potential to change the lives of millions of India's rural poor. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And that's all for today's program. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.